There is one thing which I think isn't widely known, that he was a true liberal politically. He included the Marseillaise in at least four of his works, and these start very, very early and go on to his one of his very latest works. That, and the Marseillaise meant to him the ideals of the French Revolution, that is, liberty, equality, and brotherhood, fraternity. And I think his love of Beethoven was in part a love of that, you know, the prisoner's chorus in Fidelio, where the prisoners come out of the dungeon where they've been unjustly imprisoned into the light. And what do they cry out? They cry out, freedom. And that is what, you know, that he really believed in that. And I don't think that aspect of his life or his music is widely known. So I'd like to I'd like to stress that as an element in his life and his music.
Well, you refer to your role in founding Poems on the Underground.
Oh, yeah.
For some of our listeners who may not be familiar with that, what was the aim of that, and how does that underscore your getting art to the public?
It wasn't really a plan. It was just that it was about 30 years ago, and not long after we moved from New York to London, that myself, my husband, my children. I used to travel on the London Tube, as it's called, all the time, as one does. And there were a lot of empty advertising spaces. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice just to have a short poem here and there on the Tube? And I just wrote with this idea to the managing director of London Transport. I didn't know who it was. And I had this wonderful response saying, well, go see our advertising manager. We might be able to do something about this. And it took about a year and raising a bit of money from the Arts Council, which is like, I don't know, the National Endowment for the Arts, but not a lot of money, just to get the project started. And lo and behold, it was launched by London Transport at one of their old underground stations, and it was on television programs. You know, everybody came to write it up. It seemed to strike a chord, and it's prospered ever since. And because it got so much publicity, the poems only appear three times a year, and they're sort of randomly placed here and there, about six poems at a time. But there was a wonderful public response to them, and quite soon other cities followed. I think Dublin was the first one to do so. And then New York, of course, that now has Poetry in Motion. And I was involved in that. In fact, I started on the first meetings of transit, you know, the Transit Authority in Brooklyn. And we discussed the project and how it should work. And I think it's been there except for one year when it wasn't happening. But it's happening again now. And we've had exchanges of poems with New York and also with St. Petersburg and Moscow and Beijing. I mean, it's really spread all over the world. It's very nice. What was the idea behind it? Well, just the thought that poetry belongs to everybody. And the greatest poetry speaks to huge numbers of people in a very direct way. It doesn't need explanation. It doesn't need footnotes or that sort of thing. It's just there, and it just can make you feel happy or sad or respond in one way or another. And apparently that's the way people responded to it and respond still.
Like so many other composers, Schumann did respond to poetry and other literary masterworks through his writing. It seemed to take him a little longer to really appreciate the aspect of songs and that approach. But how did you see his use of poetry and the way it manifested itself through his settings?
Well, yeah, I think his songs are among his very greatest works. I mean, they are so beautiful. And I think the poets, he said, he has wonderful settings of the poet Heinrich Heine, who was, though he was German and he wrote in German, he lived most of his life in Paris, and he was really a very sophisticated figure. But the poems that Schumann said, and the poems of his youth, they're love poems of a very melancholy kind. Now, Schumann just responded to these absolutely as if he'd written them himself. But of course, he didn't have to write them. There they were. They were written for him. And I think his settings of them, he just poured all his love of Clara into them, and his fears that perhaps she wouldn't be his. Perhaps her father would marry her off to somebody else. I mean, it was very strange that he held on to the fears that had always been part of his relationship with her long after he needed to. I mean, he wrote these songs about 9-10 months before they were married, and there were obstacles, but he was very confident that they would be together. Still, the songs don't always say that. Some of them do, but not all of them. I just think these groups of songs are simply magical. I think a lot of people are, in a way, they're a niche audience because they're in German, and they don't translate well. There have been attempts to sing them in English, but that hasn't caught on so far.
Clara seems to have broken so many of the norms back there, and successfully, and she didn't, from what I could tell, it didn't seem like there was a lot of resentment against her at the time. How did she succeed so well? And what model did she perhaps play for future women in music?
Well, I think she makes a very interesting study for this whole set of questions, because she was extraordinarily successful, but also extraordinarily independent. And maybe that's the element that we think would have been most difficult for a woman in that time. In fact, there were quite a few women who were making careers in music alongside Clara, and she knew many of them, like Jenny Lind, for instance, who just shot to fame as the Swedish Nightingale. She just had a voice beyond anyone's dreams, and she was so much in demand that she concertized everywhere. And there were other singers, of course. Pauline Viardot. There was a very famous set of two sisters, Malibran and Pauline Viardot, and they both had very successful careers as singers. And there were other pianists too, like Clara Novello, of the great Novello publishing family, who also had a career alongside Clara. But I think in Clara's case, it was partly this monstrous father of hers who was very ambitious for her, but also in a way for himself. That is, she was his, it's a bit like Shylock, my daughter, my ducats. She earned the money that supported the family, which is extraordinary. This is when she was 14, 15, 16 years old. He kept the money, but she earned it. And later, when she married Schumann, she concertized. She also had seven children in the space of about 14 years, but nonetheless, she kept on concertizing, and she was doing it for the family, for Schumann, to promote his music, but she was also playing regular concerts of music by other people, by Mendelssohn and Chopin and Beethoven, and some of the lesser-known composers who wrote very virtuosic piano concertos and so on. How did she do it? After Schumann's death, she was determined to concertize in order to pay for all their expenses. Everybody wanted to help out, send her money. She wouldn't take it. She was determined to do it herself. And it was partly that it was a way of controlling and dealing with her own grief and terror when Schumann was in the asylum. She went to England for the first time and concertized there, and she was very successful. But after his death, it just became a regular career, combining concertizing and teaching, and she was offered regular teaching positions. You think again, well, wasn't it difficult for women to have a position at a music conservatory? Not if they were on the level that Clara Schumann was, and she had students coming from all over Europe, from London, from America, just to study with her. And again, she's a great model. Incidentally, next year is her bicentenary. She was born in 1819, so there's going to be a great deal of interest in Clara and in her life, her work, her and the questions that you were asking at the beginning. How did she do it? How did she achieve so much?
And actually, someone, one of my colleagues here did mention that, or suggested I mention that actually today is her birthday.
Oh, so that's right. That's right. Yeah.
So very, very fortuitous day.
Yes, it's September, what is it, the 13th, yeah.